My name is Mudassar Ahmed, and I'm the managing partner at Unitas Communications. And this is PR Unmasked. In this episode, we are joined by the executive director of the Muslim Community Network, Anika Nawabi, the executive chair of the Religion Media Center, Michael Wakelin, and Komal Hashmani, the founder of Futsap. Today, we will be discussing how the 2022 World Cup in Qatar saw the rise of Muslim stardom in the West and has brought Islam to the minds of many football fans and beyond. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome, everyone. We are pleased to welcome you to this Concordia Forum event. Today, we're joined by Komal Hashmani, the founder of Futsap, Anika Nawabi, the executive director of the Muslim Community of New York, and Michael Wakelin, the executive chair of the Religion Media Center. Komal, Anika, and Michael, I want to thank all of you for joining us. Now, Michael, I would like to start with you. The question I have for you is, what did you think of the media coverage surrounding the 2022 World Cup in Qatar?
Well, I think when it started, there was a great deal of controversy, wasn't there? Because people were thinking that this was a sports wash. And I gather as things progressed, I was actually out in Doha just after England got knocked out, speaking at another event unconnected with football. So I got a first-hand feel for it out there too. And by the time it got towards the later stages, I think everyone had been so impressed with the way it had been organised. I heard, for instance, that women out there were so pleased that they weren't getting any sense of harassment. There weren't any boorish, drunken men knocking around, because the alcohol I discovered when I asked was something like £13 for half a beer. So no one was going to throw much money out there. And I think everyone felt very safe. And obviously, the people of Doha were very polite and kind and thoughtful. It was brilliantly well organized. So by the end of it, I think people had forgotten some of the criticism from the beginning. I'm not necessarily saying that's all a good thing. There were still difficulties about it. But because it was so well done, I think in the end, football was probably the winner.
Now I'll pose a question to the panelists. Some of the coverage of the World Cup was Islamophobic. Nonetheless, many commentators state that the World Cup actually started a counter-narrative to Islamophobia. What do you think about that, Anika?
Good afternoon, everyone, here from New York. Thank you so much for this really incredible discussion, because as an avid football fan with children who are avid football fans, I'm so glad that we're having this discussion to own our narrative and shape our narrative as Muslims. What you saw on the official media channels was nothing compared to what you could see and hear from fans, from commentators, from influencers. You really saw the real story of how powerful this event was for shaping the narrative about Islam and Muslims and so forth. Folks were enjoying this event in such great numbers, and that was not reflected on the official media channels. So I think it was really shocking to see how Islamophobic the coverage was of the greatest event. And having the greatest event in a Muslim country shocked everybody. And I think that the narrative had to be owned by our own media channels. And the West really showed its true colors when it came to it.
So what particularly stood out for you, Anika, in that?
Well, there was this one Fox News commentator who posted a video on her TikTok. She was a sports presenter, Jenny Taft. She was so uncomfortable with the women's only line. She didn't feel very special being on the women's only lines. That's what she had posted on her TikTok. And actually, she had to take it down because there were other TikTokers who were countering her narrative. And she took that video down eventually because she realized that her narrative was wrong. Just the very fact that the BBC didn't cover the opening ceremony, I think what a shame on the media and its supposed neutrality or principles of journalism. How do you not cover one of the biggest sporting events, whereas you're covering every other issue to advance the narrative of Western hegemony on so many issues around the world? How do you not cover such a major event that's happening? So I think those were the issues that really stood out to me. And overall, the narrative didn't shed light on how great the infrastructure was that was developed in Qatar, how welcoming the people were. None of that coverage came on the major channels, but on TikTok, you saw that Qataris were opening their homes up. They were giving fans dates and tea after a sporting event. So the hospitality of the Qataris, the infrastructure, none of those positive coverages were made.
Thanks. Kamel, turning to you now, obviously, on the one hand, there is a lot that we saw about Muslim culture, Muslim values that people felt was a positive outlook on Muslims. But on the other hand, the media coverage a lot of people feel was biased. Where do you stand on that? Do you think overall it was a positive, or do you think overall it was negative?
Thanks, guys. Thanks for organizing this session. I run a football app, so live and breathe football. And can I just say, what a World Cup Qatar hosted. I was really fortunate to be in attendance in Doha. The first time we got the family together. And what an experience it was. I mean, if you look at it just on a sporting perspective alone, arguably the best World Cup in history. You had the biggest teams being taken down by the minnows of each group. Cameroon beat Brazil. Argentina was beaten by Saudi. Morocco beat Belgium. Tunisia beat France. You had story after story. I mean, that was just... You couldn't put a script on it. So it's a very interesting question, though, in terms of the media narrative. I mean, I was there on the ground firsthand. You know, from the moment you land in Doha, if you were disabled, you could get a free transfer to your hotel or your accommodation. If you want to use public transport, it was free. The quality of the infrastructure, putting 8 stadiums out there, the innovation spoke for themselves. You have Stadium 974, grounded in the foundation of sustainability, where they used 974 containers to build the stadium itself. They took it down and put it into different parts of the world. Just recently, in the whole Turkey-Syria tragedy, 10,000 mobile homes from the accommodation used in the World Cup were sent to Turkey and Syria. A lot of these things weren't reported even recently in the media. I feel like people who attended the event came out with a very different experience, one of real positivity, generosity, kindness. You know, I remember walking into the souk shortly after the quarterfinal, semifinal, Argentina qualified for the final. You had South Americans taking over the souk, wearing thobes emblazoned in Argentinian colors. The culture was immersive and inclusive, spoke for itself on the ground. On the outside, I think it was a different story, it felt, to be very frank, Mudassar.
Thank you. Thank you, Kamal. So, Michael, what are your thoughts on why there was a disparity between what happened and what was reported?
Well, I would defend the way that it was covered, because the BBC, for instance, and indeed sport in the UK, is very open to all. We're very anti-racist, very welcoming of LGBTQ+. And then to go to a country where that is not comfortable meant that to go in and not refer to it would have been dishonest. And that, you know, I'm a big defender of the BBC's neutrality, in inverted commas. And I think it had to tread a very difficult line. And I know some of the big football pundits on the BBC were thinking, well, I'm going out there to cover the football. No, we're not going to make a political stance about that. So I suppose in terms of not covering the opening ceremony, I think they probably thought that was the stand they took to kind of make a point. You know, I totally get it, what you've said. I mean, hopefully I introduced it correctly before you two came on and spoke about it. But it was very welcoming out there. It was lovely. Goodness me, it was. You know, it's nothing worse than boorish, drunken football fans wandering around. There was no violence. And, you know, I get all that. Hospitality was wonderful. I had a fantastic time. I was very well looked after, as we said. It was a wonderful experience. But as I was leaving, I thought, I'm not a gay man, but if I was, I'd feel a bit uncomfortable. So I think the coverage probably was about right. As I say, in the end, I think football won. But on the other hand, you can't just simply go to a country where these things are not comfortable and not refer to it in some way. So good job, brilliantly put on. But, you know, there were some background issues there.
This is an interesting argument as to how much you reflect on the human rights record of a country that hosts a sports event. Of course, we've had major sporting events in China, Russia, and we will continue to have sporting events in many countries that have a questionable human rights record. But I don't know if I've seen a hosting ceremony being censored before. And so I think that the feeling in a lot of the Arab world is that they were being unfairly targeted because they're Muslim, even though China's and Russia's track record on this issue has far more impact on hundreds of millions of more people than tiny Qatar, even when it comes to human rights issues. But I wonder if we're going to see a shift in the way these things are reported now. Anika, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Mudassar, I totally agree with you in the sense that Russia's record on LGBTQ rights is very much similar to how Qatar views it. There was no censorship over there, whether by decision or not. It was a calculated intention by the Western media that, okay, because it's being hosted by an Islamic country, we are going to focus on the issues of alcohol and the issues of LGBTQ rights, right? The World Cup is going to be held in the United States and the Americas in 4 more years. Should we say that, hey, we're going to make race the issue in the United States when it comes to the coverage? I don't think that's going to happen, right? So this is where I think the hypocrisy was so blatant, because exactly as you said, Matasser, there were no other sporting events in other countries where the focus was on those human rights issues, right? As a journalistic organization, you cover what you need to cover, you know?
Anika, I wonder if we're going to see a shift. I'm actually really interested in that question, like whether we'll see a shift now. In the way these things are reported, in the way that maybe there's just been a change in the general zeitgeist of the media or in the general mood music as to how sporting events are going to be, because there has been a rise in activism and all sorts of other issues. Maybe this will be a shift. I don't know. We'll see. Moving on, Kamel, we're beginning to see the rise of individual religiosity in football players, which I think is an interesting aspect. You know, a lot of Muslim players are very proud of their identity. Christian players are beginning to be open about their faith identity. How do you think the impact of these players owning their religious identity is going to affect the sport?
It's an interesting question, because we see a lot of practicing Christian footballers have their own symbol to remember and be thankful for God and what he's given and what they've received. I think that transcends across other religions. Case in point, Mo Salah has been synonymous with this prostration post-match. But it wasn't the first time that this was done. You have players in the past, like the Demba Bars, that have prostrated after scoring a goal. We've seen these things, respect and thanks being shown for quite some time. But I think it's become more synonymous now with the likes of Mo Salah, because you've had to do more as players in the professional spectrum, I think, for it to be considered normalized, like the new chant that they have for Mo Salah. Any of you guys know it?
They sing Mo Salah, don't they? What else do they say?
Mo Salah, he's a gift from Allah.
Oh, right. Right, okay.
I think there's a second line. If he score a few, then I'll be Muslim too.
Oh.
It's these sort of elements that have crept into the culture, which in tandem with humor and excellence has enabled for this conversation to hit mainstream. So they've had to do more, I think, than the average player for these type of discussions to take place. Sadio Mane is another very good example of this. You know, someone who's done so much for his community back home in Senegal. Of course, Mo Salah has again come back into the equation because they've been such exemplar sportsmen and they've won the Premier League, the Champions League. In fact, very interesting stat is Mo Salah, I think, holds the record for the fastest hat-trick in the Champions League. Sadio Mane also holds the fastest record for the hat-trick in the Premier League. You know, these players have had to really reach the pinnacle for them to be considered or their practices and beliefs to sort of filter into our culture, I think. You know, individual religiosity has played a part, but it's taken some time, especially for the minority religions, to hit mainstream media and get the attention it deserves.
It's interesting to see that there is more religious expression on the football pitch than there used to be. I support Norwich City. I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Sorry to hear that, Michael.
We could do with a few more religious players. But actually, faith and football goes back a long way. Most of the big clubs, not maybe most, or certainly a good number of the big clubs, were founded on church boys' clubs. So think of Manchester City, Aston Villa, Everton, Fulham. Many of them were actually founded on church organisations. So there was this very long link right back to the beginning of the football leagues. And I don't know where it all started, really, but lots of players now come out, including Marcus Rashford, for example. He comes out and makes quite a big show of crossing himself and pointing to the heavens. Many of them point to the heavens. I love the way Mo Salah is so obviously Muslim and religious, and the work he does for his community in Egypt is astonishing. There was a Chelsea player, too, who I think the fans spotted him out one night with a broken mobile phone. And they said, look, you know, all this money, why didn't you have a posh phone? He said, what do I need a posh phone for? You know, he drives around in a small car and gives all his money away. But I think it's a really wonderful part of football that there can be, they can now express their faith much more openly than I believe they used to be able to do it. We've recorded a television programme called Songs of Praise, which is Christians singing hymns. This was a few years ago now, back in the 1990s. But we went to Old Trafford and we thought, well, if we could fill a quarter of the stadium, that'll be the biggest songs of praise we've ever recorded, 10,000 people. A few weeks later, we had a waiting list of 10,000 for the whole stadium. We completely sold it out. That was like 60,000 people back then. Then we filled the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff with about 90,000. So, you know, there's a lot of faithful football fans out there, Christian and now Muslim, delightfully. And that's a fantastic thing. Lots of Muslims support Liverpool, apparently. I don't know why that is, but, you know. And another thing you might not know, the goalkeeper, Liverpool's goalkeeper, baptises people in his swimming pool.
Wow. Yeah. That's an interesting fact.
Yeah. And I think that's why Liverpool won the Champions League and the league, because they had so many religious people. God was so on their side. They were undefeatable.
What explains their position right now then, Michael?
Well, I... nice one. But Mane probably left. That didn't matter.
That's a good one.
Jürgen Klopp is a recognised Christian as well. Anyway.
Yeah. So, do you have a British team that you follow? And also, are Muslim soccer players having an impact in the United States? Do you guys follow them?
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't follow a club or a team. I only really come when it comes to the countries playing against each other, because I think there's a larger geopolitical thing that plays out on the football pitch. So that's when I follow football. But I want to quickly add that to see football players express their faith on the pitch, it's less about converting football fans into specific religion. It's more about expression of the values and the culture of believing in something other than yourself, something that reflects a message of larger humanity, right? So it's less about who's expressing what type of religion, but more that it's okay to express your faith traditions. As someone who grew up in Islam post 9/11 and under Islamophobia, I was very shy of showing or expressing my faith values because I didn't want to be discriminated against or anything like that. So now the fact that you have these amazing football stars who express their faith on the pitch, you know, for the youth, it gives them a boost of confidence that, okay, wow, he's doing it. So I can now as well share that I'm Muslim or something like that.
It's very refreshing, isn't it? Because football's all about ego, isn't it? It's all about ego. It's all about winning. It's all about I'm the greatest. Actually, mm-hmm. for a young player, talented young player, to point to God, Allah, and say, you know, it's down to you. Thanks. I think that's such an expression of humanity in the face of the divine. It's lovely.
That's right. And this has cultural implications, right? Because if you see most of the dominant media forces, there's a recession of not expressing your faith. In fact, there was a huge study done by the Faith and Media Initiative, and actually I was a part of that. The Global Faith and Media Study showed that 59% of respondents want more value-based or faith-based programming and content in mainstream media. Because, listen, we are raising our children in these times, right? I would rather have my kids watch and take in the values of the World Cup than the Grammys or even the Super Bowl, right? All of these expressions portray a certain culture that you want your kids to be able to see and enjoy together as a family. And so we need a lot more of that content. And I think footballers being able to express their faith is a great morale-boosting activity for our youth.
We're talking about the younger generation, Kamel. What do you think Muslims can do to inspire younger generation to pursue careers in football? Often you hear about Muslim families holding back their kids. Do you think there are things that we can do to help encourage more of that? Not the holding back, but the pursuing.
Yeah, for sure. And I just wanted to add one more point to the earlier discussion, the individual representation of your religiosity. You know, it's had cascading effect. I think in the last Premier League season, Muslim players were able to open their fast during a Premier League game. And it's through these expressions and showing who you truly are that the league and the players, the fans become much more accepting and receptive of your own belief system. So, and that was a really momentous occasion. I think you saw a lot of thanks shared by the players like Paul Pogba, Wesley Fofana, really publicly thanking the Premier League for making this possible, as well as the opposition teams. On the question of youth and participation in football and seeing it as a growth, representation is massive. Let me put it out there. Who is the holder of the Ballon d'Or today? Any guesses?
Benzema.
Benzema. Well done, Anika. If you look back 25 years ago, 1998, Zinedine Zidane had won the Ballon d'Or then. You look at cases like this, they may not be just a correlation, but there is some link there. And a story that really sort of is heartwarming for me as a big Manchester United fan is that of Zidane Iqbal. Zidane Iqbal is the first British-born South Asian to play for Manchester United. He comes from a background where his father is of Pakistani origin, his mother is of Iraqi origin. And if you look at some of the immigrants or first-generation parents who've come into this country, they never saw sport as a future for themselves, let alone for their children. But what was interesting about his father was he was a football coach as well and played a big part in his journey as he played Sunday League grassroots football for Ceylon United. And then that's what was picked up by Man United. This sort of shift in the parents' approach plays a big part. Another area I think that deserves a bit of credit is the FA's shift and stance. I think they have a Asian mentorship program where Zidane Iqbal is the recipient and a benefactor of that program. And already he's been an exemplary sort of contributor for the upcoming youth. This sort of mentorship program, I think, houses about 80 or so players, which is a small fraction of 15,000 academy players today, but it's still the highest it's ever been. So with stories from Zinedine Zidane to Karim Benzema and Zidane Iqbal, I think, and supporting program, the shifting mindsets of immigrant parents ultimately has this sort of snowball effect. And I do expect, in the same way Zidane translates into more in Arabic and growing, I do expect more of this to continue to snowball and have a bigger impact into the overall futures of young Muslims who want to be footballers.
On Friday, a job landed in my inbox from the Football Association, who are currently reaching out to all the faith communities individually to encourage greater involvement with faith communities and football. So there's a Muslim day at Wembley Stadium coming up during Ramadan. They're going to invite Muslims from all over the place to come together and break the fast together at the end of one of the Ramadan days. And I've been asked to help organise the Christian one. And I love the fact that sport is now seeing the value of religion, not only encouraging young people to be involved, but also to make the whole community from the different faiths get involved in religion too, which I think is a lovely, lovely thing, lovely idea. And I'm very keen to support that.
Yeah, do you think the sporting world has better understood the nuances of religion than many in the media world?
Well, I think it's actually not just football, by the way. I know cricket is doing the same thing. They see the value, I suppose, of the whole community getting behind the sport, which will encourage young people from young women's teams as well as men's players too getting involved. I think it's really they can see the advantage in it, certainly. Yeah, maybe more than the media. I think you're speaking a bit unkind on the media. There are people in the media who really do try to get this right.
Of course.
The religious media side particularly, we're trying
course.
To do that.
You're one of the good ones. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I think that, Anika, coming back to this coverage that you were speaking about in the States, it's interesting that you pointed out it was a Fox News reporter. Because Fox is generally better on religion, per se, you know, maybe not on Muslims, but you know, on understanding conservatism, right? Understanding, you know, maybe a better understanding the conservative values. How did you find the reporting in more sorts of traditional liberal outlets about the World Cup?
That really goes to the point in showing what Fox News really stands for, right? Like, what is conservatism for them is really very much weaved into the larger, very racist construct of how they view the United States and its relation with the rest of the world. Again, as I mentioned, I got most of my news from social media. Not to say that there isn't misinformation there, but for example, one thing, the two World Cup songs, one of the original World Cup songs, it was called Haya Haya, was actually written by a Qatari woman who also sang in the music video. It was one of the official FIFA world videos. I saw Al Jazeera covering extensively the singer, the songwriter, and her journey to being able to bring her voice into the world stage. But I saw nothing of that in Fox News. Fox News really was the only channel that was covering it here in the United States. You didn't see those side little documentaries on, okay, how did the Qatar World Cup come to be? You just saw coverage of the sports. So I think in even its omission, you can say that they're trying to weave a narrative, a very monolithic narrative, that the World Cup is taking place in Qatar, but that nothing else mattered. So I would say that is how the coverage was here in the United States.
What moment stood out for you as perhaps the most iconic and potentially positive moment for the Arab world and Muslim world through the World Cup? Was there a particular point where you thought, ah?
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
Was it the Bisht?
I mean, that was a sort of concluding point where I think you'll always remember in the legacy of the World Cup. Mm-hmm. But at any point, did I think that, you know, this narrative would change? I'm not so sure. Of course, we had different perspectives on the Bisht in itself. If you look at Argentinian fans, you know, they saw it as a mark of extreme honor. Whereas the way it was painted in the West, in some corners, wasn't the best, almost like it was forced upon him. You know, Pele was famously seen wearing a sombrero when he won the World Cup in Mexico. But the same sort of parallels were never drawn in the same respect. The legacy of the World Cup, it's an interesting one. And what happens next? It seems like the narrative has extended even recently. Just last week, you have the Qatari bid for Manchester United. The first person Sky interviewed was someone from a small human rights fan group. And it just felt like for a club that's been laden in debt for the last 15 years over a leveraged buyout that's cost the club over £1 billion. You know, this is the diamond of British football culture and football that's been paying its way for the debt of that owner. That somebody's coming in to say, you know what? We'll clear this debt. We'll make this club the best football club in the world. We'll invest in the stadium. We'll invest in the team. We'll invest in the community. We'll invest in women's football. But the first thing is to pick out on the weaknesses already of the narrative, which I felt was a bit unfair to some degree. I do hope that this does change and there's more of a balance in the conversation. But there is a hangover, I think, from the Qatar World Cup and some of the issues that were talked about.
Was there a particular moment for you, Michael, that you thought this will really change the perception?
Apart from Harry Kane missing the penalty. Well, I think the balance, you used the word balance there, and I think that there is a point there. But you're also talking about, of course, Manchester United being potentially taken over by Qatar.
Yeah.
But, you know, the same thing happened, has happened at Newcastle, same thing happened also at Man City. And lots of fans start off saying, oh, well, we don't want this money because it's coming from a country where we don't like their human rights. But they quickly kind of get over that. That's what it looks like anyway. But I don't think it should be brush on the carpet. It should be looked at, should be challenged, because those are the values that, you know, we hold dear. But on the other hand, as you say, balance. I think, you know, that there's clearing Manchester United, making them a great world club. I kind of get all that. I think the rich clubs have too much already in some ways, but it's certainly a contentious issue and not one that we should forget. But in terms of the World Cup, I can't particularly, apart from the moment when, yeah, Messi got the Bish, you say?
Yeah, yeah.
That was quite a big moment.
Mm.
That's quite touching in a way.
So, Anika, was there a particular moment for you where you thought, you know, this will change the perception of Muslims, or this is a positive thing?
Yeah, absolutely, Mudassar. I'm going to speak again on the cultural aspect of it. And I'm going to start with the music. The fact that you had hijabi women singing in the opening ceremony as well as the closing ceremony, being part of those official songs, which on YouTube, by the way, have like 43 million views, okay? That in itself is, again, a huge shaping the narrative for Muslims. You also saw the Moroccan players, when they won their World Cups, they went and they hugged their mothers, right? With the Danish media, in its Islamophobic rant, there was some comparison made to monkeys. Like, how low can you go on that? Hey, guess what? We Muslims, we love and cherish our mothers, and that's who we think about when we have some form of victory, right? That is a huge cultural shaping the narrative moment for the World Cup. And I'm going to go back to, again, the way Qatar hosted this event. It asserted its values of the fact that there will be a ban on alcohol. And in fact, Spain has a ban on alcohol when it comes to its regular games in its stadiums. No one is putting attention there, right? But it did on Qatar. But anyway, going back to the fact that it was one of the greatest sporting events, even the BBC's own poll that it made had showed that everyone thought that this was one of the greatest events. And it was done on our own terms. It was done on the terms that the Muslims, that the Qataris had set for ourselves, right? We didn't try to bend it to accommodate. We did it how we felt was the expression of our faith, our values, and our culture. I think that in itself has been a huge moment for us to be able to shape the narrative for Muslims all over the world.
Yeah, certainly for me, the Moroccan players hugging their mothers was quite special and nice and sweet and different. I think we're coming towards the end of our session here. We've tried to bite off a huge topic with so many different angles to it, but you know, bringing it back to how this impacted the perception of Muslims globally, I just want to ask the panelists to offer some closing remarks, perhaps touch on things you think we didn't touch on, and then we'll close off. So I'll start with you, Michael.
Well, I think goodness will out. And I think if we can go back to Mo Salah, who's been an exemplary man, an exemplary Muslim, who conducts himself, apart from diving a bit too easily, sometimes in the box, but he conducts himself admirably. And the fact that he's not gone on about all the stuff he's done for his community back home, that's come out from other sources. And that, for me, is going to be the big game changer. When these faithful footballers acknowledge where their talent comes from, they get ridiculous amounts of money. When a footballer can earn in a month more than a nurse gets in the entire of her career. So it's absolutely right that footballers with a good religious background are, like Marcus Rashford, giving their money away, supporting great causes, using their influence and their position on the pitch, their talent on the pitch, to do good things and to make the world, a better place. That, I think, is going to be the abiding legacy for this newfound expression of religion on the sports pitches. That's really exciting and a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge topic to unpack. Ultimately, the influence of football can be seen in so many different ways. We talk about the World Cup. We talk about players, professional football players. We have owners of football clubs across the world with Muslim affiliations. You have YouTube influencers who are linked to football in some capacity. You have chefs, someone like Big Zoo, if anyone has watched the Channel 4 show, big Liverpool football fan, but also a chef introducing food that is halal. I think there's so many things that are linked to football that can change the perception. I think it's now time all of these things come together. I think we're sort of past the tipping point where people were scared to really show who their true faiths were. And a huge credit goes to the players and the success they've had on the pitch. And hopefully there's more and more to come for the future.
Thank you. And Anika?
Yes, I want to bring it back to the question of, do Muslim parents feel more comfortable sending their kids to be sportsmen? I think whether it's sports or whether it's a profession, parents are seeking to put their children in platforms that build character. And as you mentioned, football is becoming a kind of a character building activity now, with people expressing their faith and also knowing what to do with the awards and the accolades that they get, right? So being that positive role model, I think what Muslim parents need to see in the sporting events is really proper mentorship to children who are interested in the sport, to guide them in a way that helps build their character, helps them connect to their fellow players, as well as the larger issues that are affecting the world. Sport has implications on culture, on politics, and on so many other things. You can use a sporting event to unite a world, which is what Qatar did. It united the whole world, and it gives you hope. It renews your faith in brotherhood and family. I hope that those values continue to be expressed and advanced in future sporting events.
Thank you so much. Well, look, on behalf of the Concordia Forum, I would like to thank Kamal, Anika, and Michael for joining us today and discussing this issue. Finally, the stream of today's event will also be available on the Concordia Facebook page and will be released as a podcast in around 2 weeks' time. This concludes our webinar. Thank you, everyone, for attending, and hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Thank you.